Welcome to the Nifty Podcast, presented by Partyfish Media, a showcase of the best emerging filmmakers under the age of 25 from all over the world. Film starts here at Nifty 2020 from Seattle, Washington. My name is Dan Hudson. I am Nifty's executive director. I am also one of the programmers, including the animation section at the festival, which is why I'm very excited to be talking to one of our big award winners from the festival this year, Esther Chung, who came to us with the film In Passing. Welcome, Esther.
Hello. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Can you give us a little bit of like a little mini bio, like a little rundown, tell the folks a bit about, maybe where you're based out of, anything you want to share about yourself?
Oh man. Sure. I draw a lot. I am now based in Vancouver for almost 2 years now, but originally from Toronto. And I mostly animate, but also illustrate. And I made a film called In Passing that hopefully you guys saw.
Yes, you did. And if people are listening to the podcast first, pause, watch the film. It's short, and then come back because we're going to be talking about it. But before we dive into the film, I want to ask you a little bit about where you made this film, because I personally didn't know about the Sheridan animation program. And now seeing In Passing, I'm like, I got to know more about Sheridan or see more projects that come out of Sheridan. So I just really curious, presumably you were really into illustration animation before selecting like an undergraduate program. So how'd you find Sheridan? Was there anything about that program in particular that pushed you as an artist, or like that you enjoyed the experience? Or we can also cut this if it was a terrible experience.
No, it was great. I mean, it was, that was a lot of questions. I guess starting off. Yeah. So I guess I always like to draw. So it kind of made sense to go and just learn to draw. And there was like animation or illustration, and I was kind of choosing which one to do. But I think animation made more sense for me, because like animation, you're moving a lot of drawings, versus illustrating, you're learning how to draw a still image. So I'm like, I can learn how to illustrate if I learn how to move illustrations. So I kind of just like did both of those while studying animation. Yeah, it was like the closest school to where I lived, and it's a really good one. So it kind of made sense. It was like a perfect storm.
That worked out.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like, you know, coming from a, you know, an illustrative background as well, and not purely into animation just for like the film, you know, animation as film's sake. You've got a very like diverse set of styles that you can work between, and I think that they all look really good. So I'm really curious, like what sort of styles like you gravitate towards the most? Are you just like trying to like test yourself or push yourself like as many directions as possible? Because like In Passing has very strong look. But you've got a lot of other things that you've worked on that don't look like In Passing at all.
Yeah, totally. I guess like I don't have so much of a one distinct voice as like a lot of illustrators do. I also work in commercials, so you kind of have to just do what the client wants, and that's like a lot of different styles. And so you got to be versatile in that sense. But yeah, I guess I'm always trying to push myself in different areas, not just one specific style, but push like one style with a lot of color, or one style with a lot of black and white, and just like, or one style that's a lot of shape. And so I'm like trying to just push the different areas and see different ways I can get better. Yeah, so I guess for In Passing specifically, I was just trying to choose the style that worked for the story the most, basically.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about that style because I watch a fair amount of animation and anime and all sorts of different stuff. But like one of the things that it kind of reminded me of, are you familiar with like Tekkon Concrete?
I love Tekkon Concrete.
Okay. I was like, I was feeling that and I was like, man, I'm wondering if there's like any sort of like spiritual connection here, but yeah. what were some of those sort of like touchstones or sort of visual references that when you were approaching the style for In Passing?
Yeah, so Tekkon Concrete was really good that I was looking at specifically for perspective and the way they compose city shots. Because that whole movie is just crazy, crazy good city shots. And it's so lived in and you're so immersed. Even like under the bridge and like everywhere. It's just so good. Yeah, so I love that. And especially the character designer on that in that movie. I don't remember his name off the top of my head right now, but he's great. I was also, because the film is set in Hong Kong, I wanted, and the city is so much an important part of the place and the story. I wanted to, all my visual references basically were films and movies and artwork from, I guess, Asian cinema. So a lot of who I was looking at was Wong Kar-wai, who's a Hong Kong director. Mm-hmm. And he has like a lot of like gritty nightlife, really cinematic stuff. But I was like trying to reverse it and just do like the daytime story of that sort of, and like the not so gritty version. And yeah, and just trying to like capture that cinematic feel as well. And then I was also looking at a lot of Taiwanese new wave and just like the filmmaking and that and how they tell stories, because it's not so linear. I find the way they tell stories in, I guess, Asian sort of cultures are less straightforward than the three arc story structure in like Marvel movies, say, or Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah. The classic like hero's journey or whatever.
Like, I kind of try to steer away from that just because it was, it's super done, and also it's very predictable, especially in a short film. And so I wanted something that would be more immersive, but less that. So it, maybe it'd be interesting. And even if I failed at it, maybe it'd be interesting in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, but one of the things that is great about it, because it doesn't have that that super defined narrative structure, is that I found it like very hypnotic and like endlessly rewatchable. Like it's almost kind of like, it's almost poetic where like I can just like sit there and just like let it wash over me. And I'm wondering if you've like had that response from anybody else who's like watched it, if there's, because it is very atmospheric. You just if you feel very present.
Oh, that's what a compliment. Thank you. I think I have gotten that. I think I tried to make it very much just slice of life. This is just, I didn't really work with a story, and I think my teachers were kind of annoyed at that when I kept on trying to present my idea, or like, I'm just like, I don't, it's kind of like this, but not really like this. It's a mood. I'm trying to capture a feeling. And so the whole time I wasn't trying to make an arc with like the story. I was trying to make an arc with the feeling, which is so much more vague. And so it was kind of frustrating, and I think for them, extra frustrating.
Well, I can imagine that, like, as far as pitching it, it would be really hard to like get that across, right?
Yeah, it was super hard, especially because like my boards were mostly legible just from me, like by me, because it was so feeling. I'm just like, all right, chicken scratches, we're just gonna like do this. And then I have to like explain half the thing because it doesn't come off in just like, everything was in the details basically that comes in after in the later stages. And so my boards were just like compositions. They were like barely legible to anybody who didn't understand what I was like trying to do. So like, I'd have to spend like 30 minutes trying to explain what these boards were. And like, I'm like, imagine this other thing, imagine it with these colors and imagine like this feel. And so they're like, okay. And so it was like hard to pitch, but I think it was after a while they figured that they just needed to, I guess, or let me do my thing or try.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost got sort of like an essay quality to it, or like, cause I mean, your log line for the film is a portrait of 70s Hong Kong as my parents remember it. So it does kind of have that sort of like fog of memory, sort of like dreamlike quality to it. Does that make sense? Was that also like how you were having to try to explain it to folks?
Totally. And like, I was trying to write that log line kind of while I was making the film. Like, it kept on changing as I went. Like, I knew what I wanted to do, but I didn't know how to explain it, I think. And so the whole time I was like boarding the film, I was talking with my parents, I was talking to like family in Hong Kong and trying to figure out what exactly the feel is. And so I'm just like collecting all these stories that I want to filter into this film that's like a mood.
And you were also saying that like a lot of it was in the details. So I just wanted to like ask you about a couple of details that sort of like stood out to me. So I guess you could also say like potentially these are interrelated, but every time I watched it, I was like, okay, what does the dragonfly symbolize? What do the airplanes symbolize? So I was going deep, but I'm wondering for you, like, because those are sort of like, I guess you could say almost the sort of narrative through line of the film, right?
Yeah. So those are all things that I gathered from the stories. So my dad actually had one of his stories he was telling us was when he was a kid, he would play with dragonflies. He would catch them, tie them on a string, and just fly them, basically, like a kite. And there was an airport in Hong Kong at that time that's not there anymore, but it used to be in a different part of town. And the way that the airplanes would have to land and take off was right above the building. So it was like just a thing for everybody living in Hong Kong to always have these airplanes going by that are so low and like almost going to hit the buildings. Mm-hmm. And there's like such great like photos from that time where these airplanes are just massive. Like now we see them and they're like itty bitty little things in the sky.
Yeah.
But no, they're just like massive in the photo and they look like they're about to land on top of the building. And so, yeah, like it's funny that you say you read into it and like I've been told people read into it and I'm like, what does it mean? And I was like, I mean, they're just like, I'm just real things that have happened that I've been told. And so I'm kind of just remaking it kind of in like a documentary-esque sort of way.
Yeah, yeah. I was feeling that. Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at with the sort of like essay sort of comparison is that it feels like documentary in a sense. But I guess as far as like what I was reading into like the potential symbology, and I'm wondering like what other people like might have like projected onto it. But it felt like these people were like really listless, and like the dragonfly and like the plane were like kind of escaping.
Yeah,
maybe.
I mean, that's a good read. For me, I always just like, I'm not trying to show the scary, but definitely. I mean, the characters are based off of my parents, and my parents moved to Canada. And so it's kind of like totally that's a thing. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of people from that generation and afterwards have immigrated or emigrated out of Hong Kong to different mm-hmm. places. And so it's 100% a thing. But also that time was just so, everybody was so trapped in their own worlds, you know? It's like there was so much poverty back then. There was so much disparity in the communities. And so it's just, that totally could be a read-in.
All right. I'll stick with it then. It works for me. So you were talking a bit about your your storyboarding process, especially around like, you know, trying to pitch the project and, you know, helping people see. I noticed that on some, you storyboarded for a few projects now, and I'm wondering, is this kind of like your like sweet spot where like you get to like do the illustration, but you get to be involved in like considering the motion? Like, are you a storyboard artist for life, or do you want to do more directing? Or
so I totally think I have found a sweet spot. I love storyboarding. It's like, as you said, I get to think about the movements of how things work. And then I also get to think about the illustrate, like in an illustrative quality, how things are laid out and like the compositions of it, which I love to do. And so, yeah, totally. But I love storyboarding. I think I used to never really, I never wanted to be a storyboard artist. Like that was never my like aspiration or whatever. I kind of just wanted to draw. And so being given these roles, and I'm like, oh my goodness, it's like super fun. And like, it's very exciting and I really like it. And I get to look at the big picture, which is super awesome. And I'd like totally be down to do more directorial things as well. I'm kind of just like, if a cool idea comes along and I feel like I have a good vision or good idea for it, I think, yeah. Yeah, I'd be totally down to direct more.
So film is nothing without sound. And I thought that the soundscape on this film really worked, again, to kind of like get that atmospheric feeling, but also, you know, the sense of, you know, memory and sort of like out of time a bit. So I had a couple questions for you here. First of all, like, I feel like you have to watch this with like headphones or really good sound system, because that your mixing on like the dragonfly and stuff was like legit. So how did you work with somebody on that? Like, or that's very hard to pull off like in any film, like let alone a student film. So
yeah, shout out to my sound designer, Andrew, and my composer, Sergey. He did like a super, super good job. I was very particular about those two. I was like, we got to be immersed. You need the layers. So I was working with Andrew a lot. It was really, really good. It was like maybe a couple months into the production of the film. He's already started. Well, I like met him and he got to work on it, which is super sweet. And there was like some specific sounds I knew I needed. And I was in Toronto at the time. And I was like, how am I going to get like the authentic sounds of Hong Kong? There's just the sound of Hong Kong where there's just like always a noise. Wherever, however quiet it is, there's just always a noise of like, just like the low hum of like traffic, airplanes and sirens and different things. There's just always a noise. And like people speaking in Cantonese, just constantly that like chatter. And so I was like, so my sister was going back to Hong Kong and I was like, okay, I went out, quickly bought a recorder. And then I sent her with it with like exact instructions of like places to go.
Oh, wow.
And what to record. Nice. Like I was like, record the door frame closing because I need that, and record it from this angle and this angle, and go to the specific building and record the like in the hallways in the column. Wow. Just sit there 3 minutes, just record here. And I was like, do it from the 10th floor, do it from the 20th floor. And then I got her to do all that and then upload it to me from Hong Kong, basically, while she was on her trip traveling.
Wow.
Yeah. Nice. And my aunt helped with that too, just like taking her around and like doing that. And then I sent these files to Andrew and I was like, can you work them in? Just like, here's the door. Here's just like Foley, just like ambiance of like the street. Here's the building and like, it might work out, it might not, but he worked those in and I think it really helped on top of like the amazing work he does that I don't know how he does it. This is the part that I can talk about. Whereas like I told my sister to go and get these sounds from me, basically.
You know, you mentioned like the sort of like chatter of Cantonese that's like part of the Hong Kong soundscape. And one of the things that I noticed was like that you can almost like watch this film without any subtitles and still like get the film. I mean, it's like almost dialogue free, and like the spoken dialogue is almost just like a track of sound in the film. And I was wondering, has that helped, excuse me, the film's reception to like, English speaking audiences, or just like audiences like of all shapes and sizes, as far as like it, because it kind of has that, it's almost like a dialogue free film in a sense.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I feel like the weather report kind of is the most vital part, maybe.
Yeah.
Where you kind of have to know, but also, I mean, Angie did a good job in making it sound like it was coming from a radio. So, I don't know. I totally think that having it dialogue free like helps it cross borders, because it's less reliant on what people are saying. And I think that's always the good thing in film. It's like a visual language versus language language. Yeah. Funny story about the weather report. Cause I had built the story up so that it goes like as an escalating typhoon. And my friend's aunt or something was a weather reporter, like an actual one in Hong Kong. So she knows like how they say things. So that is her saying the act, like a fake actual weather report.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it was super authentic. And she just like sent me a recording through WhatsApp, and was like, and it just made the final cut.
You also mentioned, you gave a shout out to your composer there. And, you know, you mentioned this is, a portrait of the 70s. I think it said like 1976 or something, maybe at some point in the film.
Yeah.
The music kind of sounds like it could be from that era as well, or at least like has the sort of, you know, maybe in the same sort of like dreamlike quality, like the sort of like idea of like what the song would be like from that era. And I was wondering like how you approach that from the composition, and if there was like any specific like, you know, music research from that Hong Kong in that era.
Yeah. So I was trying to dig, well, I was kind of trying to get my dad to give me what he listened to back then. But I like in my digging, I found that they mostly listen to like American pop, which is like this really strange thing. So I was like, what? And it feels kind of off, but everybody wanted to listen to pop from like America, like English.
Yeah.
And so that was quite interesting, because it was just like, I don't know, I guess it was because it's a British colony and like people are moving forward and they're leaving all the opera behind or something. So yeah, that was kind of cool. I had like, so I pulled from like the Cocteau Twins and like 80s inspired music. And then I was just like, I gave a few tracks to Sergey to like look at and listen to. And I was like, can we replicate, do something like this that feels kind of dreamy, but like very synthy, but like 80s, but kind of not.
Yeah.
And then he kind of like worked with it. And then we went back and forth a few times. And then it was actually only supposed to come in during the credits, original story. But then, like, last minute, I was, like, a month before I was, like, putting it all together, I was like, can we add sax? And then
I love that sax. That's what Brad home for sax. Me.
Same. I was like, okay, it didn't have any sax, like, a month before it was only supposed to be, like, 10 seconds of the short. Like, the music comes in right at the credits. This is when there was no sax. And then I was like, can we add sax? And then he comes back to me like a month later. And then with this like dope sax soundtrack, it just like the sax just carried it. And I was like, oh my goodness, I have to make it longer. So now it like plays for like a quarter of the film, and it's great. And I love it. And I was like, okay, you made magic.
Nice. Well, like one other like touch point on that, to like bring it back to saying early, it also kind of like lends that like Wong Kar Wai like vibe to the film, right?
It does, because it's sax. Sax,
yeah,
is so
yeah.
Wong Kar Wai's films, he's got amazing soundtracks in his movies, and they're great.
And you had mentioned that you considered this a slice of life film, so very fitting that it won an audience award at NIFTY for the slice of life screening. Also won Best Animation Student, a jury award. So Like the critics love it, the audiences love it. I know you've played a few festivals now, so I'm just like, what's your kind of feeling about like the reception of the film, or like playing festivals like in our weird like virtual times?
I think most of the festivals happened prior, maybe like half of the festivals. It was basically starting in festivals all the way since in 2019.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of been in, and I'm surprised it's going for this long, to be honest. I was like, whoa, people still wanna watch it. Yeah, so I think the reaction or the reception is way more than I expected. I didn't expect this much, or like people to like it, or I thought it'd be like kind of weird and not that likable. So I'm like surprised and thankful that people like it so much.
Well, hopefully everybody listening to the podcast liked it as much as we did, and is eager to see more of your work. So this is the time of the show where you get to plug your Instagrams, your Vimeos, your whatever you want to like throw out there so people can learn what's next. Or and also you can feel free to plug a project now too if you want to talk about what you're working on.
I'll totally plug in my Instagram because I just upload it with drawings and whatever I'm working on. It's just Esther_Chung. Simple.
Easy peasy. Well, yeah. Esther, I want to thank you again for joining. I love the film, and this was it was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. For more information on NIFTY 2020, the talented youth and more emerging filmmakers, check out nifty.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at NFFTY or on Instagram at Nifty Film. For more podcasts from Party Fish Media, search Party Fish Media wherever you listen to podcasts or follow us on social media at Party Fish Media.
Party Fish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on Indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org or realrentduwamish.org.